Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to give you a warm welcome to a session which will bring us to a topic from a warm continent, much warmer right now than compared to Berlin. I think we're all struggling a little bit with the cold here. I'm happy that you're interested in that topic. I hear that most of the participants went to the first panel, but we are obviously trying our best to give you a good insight into the African blogosphere. This is the topic we're dealing with today. My name is Christian Echle. I'm the head of the CAS Media Program for Sub-Saharan Africa, based in Johannesburg. And today I brought three bloggers with me from different African countries. Two of them, Ruth and Jimmy, are in a network that we established just a few weeks ago, a network for political bloggers, which is called Africa Blogging. And also Pierre DeVos is with me. He's not part of the network, but still a very influential blogger. I will give a little more information on our panelists in a moment. But first of all, I would like to give a quick introduction on the topic itself. So when Chancellor Angela Merkel hosted an innovation conference this week. She also talked to people from the iHub in Kenya, and they presented a device to her, which is called the BRIC. The BRIC is a small device which carries internet into rural areas of Africa. It has a very, it needs only very few energy, it has a good battery, it has a strong reception. So this is just a part of the phenomenon that you can see all over Africa. It's the continent with the lowest internet rate. Yes, that's true, but it's changing, and more people are getting online, especially through mobile devices. That's why, from our point of view, it is important to deal with the actors who are actually putting content, African content, into the internet. In many countries that we are active in, we have very low quality media, we have laws which are actually very restrictive when it comes to the freedom of speech, and that's why we think it's important to enable bloggers in Africa to give their opinion, to take part in the public discussion. And this brings me to our three panelists who are actually role models and examples of well-known and well-read bloggers in their respective countries in Africa. Just one note maybe, when Spiegel Online reported on the Innovation Congress of the Chancellor, they wrote that the Chancellor talked to people from Australia, Great Britain, Brazil, and Africa. And there we had it again, Africa as a country. So we try to avoid this here. Africa is a continent. We are all very aware of that. And I will now introduce you to the bloggers from different African countries. We'll start with Ruth. Ruth Aine Tindyeba from Uganda. She's a journalist, blogger, and social media trainer. And apart from her own blog, which is called In Depth, she's also writing for the Youth Hub Africa, which presents young talents from different African countries. She's working for the Future Challenges blog of Bertelsmann Foundation and the blogs of the Deutsche Welle. She mainly deals with topics like tech, society, politics, health, gender, and youth. To my right-hand side, we have Jimmy Kainja from Malawi. He's a lecturer for communication sciences at the Chancellor College of the University of Malawi. His blog deals with media, politics, development, and governance. And he's also writing for the blogs Africa on the Block and Voices of Africa. I hope that all of you will start following their blogs and their Twitter channels right after the session. And last but not least, I would like to welcome Professor Pierre DeVos from South Africa. He's a professor for constitutional governance at the University of Cape Town. On his blog, Constitutionally Speaking, he's dealing with the social and political developments in South Africa from a perspective of constitutional law. The blog entry which was most read so far, he told me just before, was the blog entry on Oscar Pistorius. So I think that's a phenomenon which is well known here in Germany as well. And some of his blog entries are also shared and published on the Daily Maverick, which is one of the leading online news platforms and opinion platforms in South Africa. So much for a very quick intro. Obviously, with my first round of questions, I would like you to tell us a little bit more about what you're doing, what brought you into blogging. We will have about 30 to 40 minutes of discussion here on the panel, and then I would like to open the questions also for the audience, so you can take part in the discussion. And I would like to suggest again that we start with ladies first. Ruth, when did you start blogging, and what was your motivation to get into it?
Thank you very much, Christian, for the warm introduction. When did I start blogging? As he had told you, I'm a journalist, trained journalist, and I graduated 2009, and that is when I left university. I started blogging about 2008, but then it was very, very personal stuff. It was about what made me cry, what made me sad. It was just, you know, sharing about myself, because the person who introduced me to blogging was saying, hey, there's a way in which you're going to be able to have a personal website. And I said, huh? It's like, yeah, it's a personal website. It's like just to have your own page, you know, online. And I was like, I thought that was pretty cool. So that's how I started out. And after a while, like Twitter, you open something and then forget about it for a while. And that's what happened. 2010, I started work officially. I didn't remember that I had one. I would, I think, put one or two postings. And then 2011, I had just met with the trainers from the Deutsche Welle Academy who came to Uganda to help us with the training on election reporting, and they said, well, can you write something for us? We want to put it on our blog. I said, oh, okay. So I wrote about two or three stories, and that was the time when Twitter was beginning to be something in Uganda. So we did a lot of covering of the elections using Twitter and using the hashtag Uganda Decides. And that is when I, you know, decided, when they talked to me about blogging, I said, I used to have a blog, you know, that is when I remembered. So I'd like figure out once again, how do I use this platform? And so 2011 is when I rediscovered my blog, and 2012 is when I started writing, getting serious with my writing, because I was taken on as a tech blogger with one of the, you know, online magazines in Uganda. And then after a while, it wasn't working out, the relationship. So he was promising me money. He wanted me to write one article at the end of, I mean, every week. And then, I mean, sometimes there would be nothing to write about. Sometimes there would be nothing related to technology that I wanted to write about, because, you know, writing sometimes is passion, is a lot more than just, you know, putting words onto paper. All this time, you know, typing. And then, so we got a few, you know, disagreements here and there. And then I decided, I said, why don't I put my energy, instead of developing someone's brand, why don't I start, you know, creating my own brand? And so that is how I decided just to, you know, start putting content on my blog. And soon after, Future Challenges, which was run, because it was a project run by Bertelsmann Stiftung, was on Twitter asking for bloggers from East Africa. I said, well, I would like to blog. I sent through my CV, and the regional editor, who was from Ghana at that time, Mac Jordan, wrote me back and said, yes, I think we'd like to work with you. And so between that, I think 2013, I was discovered again by Foresight for Future Development, which is an online project run by the Future Society in Africa, but based mainly in Johannesburg. And so they asked me to write for them as well. On and off, here and there, you have lots of initiatives coming, asking for a voice online. Can you cover us? Can you write for us? Can you attend our events and be able to share from your heart how you perceive us and, you know, put our work online? And, you know, slowly by slowly, I started up. You know, being able to write and put content online.
So at which stage did you decide to say, okay, this was personal so far, but I'm trying to really to be an opinion maker and to research, go to into depth with my research, into depth, the name of your blog.
Well, the thing about it is I did not want this to be an average blog. And I think, because even when I was writing personal articles, I had one or two people come up to me and say, your writing is good. You are not writing like everyone else is writing. And so I wanted to be, I wanted to stand out and be a thought maker and not an opinion leader, not necessarily speak as everyone is speaking. I just wanted to be able to give an alternative to, to what other people are saying. Because you realize with this mainstream media, the average story in a newspaper is, especially in Uganda, is probably going to be 400 words. That is what the... Because they're just talking about how, where, when, how it happened, who is involved, and that's it. There's not so much in-depth writing when you come to the, to the media in Uganda. And then you have... I have submitted papers to... stuff to the newspapers, and I find, like, the last 20 or so words are gone, And I'm thinking, this is not what I want. Or sometimes it is how the editor views the story that you're trying to tell. So it is not necessarily your idea or your opinion. So from the very word go, I wanted this to be something that where I put my all in, where I would go and give a well-researched story, or even just, because some of these things are, it's not rocket science. Some of these things exist. It's just that we have not taken time to find out what the right, what the right content is, or what the right figures are, or what, who else has talked about what we're trying to write about. And so I just wanted it to be different and have a lot of content, but also stuff that was right. That way that if someone read it, they would identify me as someone who made sense. I really was cautious about the image that I put out there. And so... From the onset, it was try and make sense of what you're trying to, say.
Pierre, in your academic discipline, people are not really well known for writing like short, smart texts. It's more like the lengthy version with a lot of commas. So when did you decide to leave this way and to become a blogger?
Well, I can't really remember, I'm an academic, so I obviously publish in academic journals, legal journals mostly. And there was a time when I published an article where I quoted, she's become a little bit famous now, RuPaul, the drag queen. I quoted her and also put a swear word in there, in this very serious legal journal. I thought, ooh, this is going to upset everybody. Nobody noticed. Because nobody reads, actually, the legal journals. It's very boring. So, at the same time, I became a little bit known among journalists for giving comments, explaining constitutional issues, legal issues, in the media, like an analyst or commentator. And I got very irritated because many of the journalists were very uninformed. And, I remember when the president was removed from office, Thabo Mbeki, the previous president, one journalist I was explaining about 45 minutes, one section of the Constitution, which is actually very clear. It's very, very clear. But she couldn't understand this. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is too much. I'm just going to write it in a blog. And I'm going to explain this in 1,500 words. And so I started publishing in that way. So I think more or less that's how it started. In the beginning, there was more of a mix. I would also put slightly more personal things on it, things that I got from other blogs and from other places. But over time, I realized that I'm what I'm really talking about, that it's more of a specific topic. It's more of South African politics, but through usually, not always, but usually through a legal lens or an academic lens.
In a recent post, you dealt with the Charlie Hebdo attacks from your perspective, and maybe for the audience to understand how you what's your angle on a topic. Maybe you can explain a little bit on how you tackled that.
What happens is often I'm an academic, ne? So I'm trying to be a little bit critical and self-reflective. So I got a bit irritated with everybody jumping on the bandwagon and saying, "Je suis Charlie." I mean, really, it's not this. No, we are not Charlie because none of us are being murdered for what we write. So I got a bit irritated by that, and also by the fact that people say, well, freedom of expression is sacrosanct. You cannot limit it for anything in the world. And these kind of slogans were put out there by politicians, all those politicians who stood there in Paris. While at home in their own countries, they probably lock up journalists. And so I just thought, well, let's just go and look at the European Court of Human Rights and what it says about freedom of expression and how many times have it actually limited freedom of expression and justified it. And I found very strange things, including one about, the one case was about people who tried to put up posters about extraterrestrials and in Austria, and the Austrian government said, no, you cannot do this because it will disturb the morals of society. And the European Court of Human Rights said, yes, this is a perfectly acceptable limitation on freedom of expression. So I put it on the blog just to make the point that although I wish there was more expansive protection of freedom of expression within Europe, in reality, it is not the case.
Jimmy, you're an expert on Malawian politics with your blog. When did you start to get into blogging, and how did you develop since then?
Thanks. Set up a blog about, I think, 2006, 2007. But then how these things work, sometimes you set up something and you actually forgot about it. But what led me to it is because I left my country for London to study. So I was almost like disconnected from my own environment, the friends I grew up with. So this was around the time when social media was really taking off. We're experimenting with MySpace, Facebook. There's High Five at the time. So trying to look around for friends that I left back home. And that's what one way or the other brought to me realities of social inequalities, because the way I grew up in my country, I grew up in both sides of the country. So I grew up in urban areas where my parents worked, and then I spent most of the time with my grandparents in rural areas. So I developed friends in both sides of the country. It ended up that few friends that I could find that only those based in urban areas. So I'd been cut out from other people that I could interact with. So trying to reason, I was young then, trying to reason how all this is happening, you know, led me to, you know, another thing and trying to understand how social differences are. I was then studying media communication, but as a social science subject. So I was getting into issues of sociology, looking at how societies change and how societies work. Led to my conclusion that most of the problems that we have in society really begin and end with politics, how politics work in the countries. So I was discussing this one day with my former lecturer then. So I said, what do you do about it? Why don't you start writing about it and maybe keep documenting on your thoughts and all that? So that led me to start blogging around 2008. It was actually the same lecturer said to me, look, if you're writing something, be it a newspaper, be it a magazine, whatever, you know, there's a process. You need to come up with information and you need to find a way of distributing it and all that. So when I jumped on Twitter, you know, so whatever I have to write, I find a way of putting it out there that people can find out. So what I do most of the time now is really a cross of, blogging and putting the stuff on Twitter. And things that I write most of the time, it's not just something that just come up to me, I need to write about this. It's definitely what is happening in society, because I follow trends on Twitter, see what people are discussing. So I look at it and see, try and challenge and critique the way people are thinking. And I think that has also developed further, because at the end of my studies, I find myself looking, asking myself, what's next? So I thought I was pretty much interested in academic issues, and I thought I'd stay in the academia, as it is, I work an academic now. So I try now to do a lot of research, to look beyond what's obvious in the face of the public, look for evidence, and you know, try to analyze things and put it into maybe sort of better academic perspective, you know, for like better analysis. For example, just this morning, woke up, so I was checking news back home. The country is undergoing, you know, a lot of problems, water issues, electricity, and all that. So one of the papers is criticizing a public relations officer from the water department for apparently telling lies to the public. So I was putting out on Twitter, I said, look, she should be actually promoted, because public relations people, this is what they do. They lie to you. They are employed to hide information or to give information. So for journalists, you need to go beyond public relations people if you want to get actual information. I've had 2, 3, 4 emails. You know, everybody thinks I'm out of press to, you know, to suggest that. So all those kind of issues that I try to sort of challenge and put perspectives on.
The great topic for this conference is the digital transformation and how it affects society. Out of the three countries which are represented on the panel, Malawi is still behind when it comes to the number of internet connections, the connectivity in general. So how would you describe the picture? Does the digital sphere have an influence on the Malawian society? I mean, obviously, when you say you check Twitter for different opinions, you talk to people, how many people are there actually? Is it visible at all?
Yeah, it is actually very small. And statistically, I think it's 5.1% of the population. The country has about 15 million people. So when you look at it, there's very few people that have access to the internet. And when you start deducting from that figure, it includes, say, my own grandmother. That can be counted as someone who's got access to digital information, but she doesn't use it in anyhow. So the figure is very, very small. Most people that use it, they'll use it for, say, on Facebook for personal issues and all. And it also includes maybe a lot of investors and institutions that are there for different purposes. So penetration is very, very low, but it's growing, because when you look at the last figures in 2012, it was only 3 point something, and 3 years later, it's 5.something%. So the growth is there. But also, beyond the actual use of the internet, it's a fact that I think, like most African countries, Malawi sort of has jumped the technology one way or the other. Because when Western countries start having internet, you know, have those modems and connections that you need a landline phone to connect and all that, Africa has actually really jumped from that technology. Most people use mobile technology, so use mobile phones. And at the same time, mobile phones, especially smartphones that are very, very good with internet connections, are very expensive, and you know, you cannot find them in Africa in many cases. Not to mention the price of having internet connection itself. But beyond that, it's because most people use basic phones, and you know, still the technology is there because people can access different information, say on markets, on agriculture, using text messages, basic messages on their phones. They can check on maybe medical issues and all that. So all this is really growing. Though the internet penetration itself is low, but the use of mobile technologies in Africa is huge at the moment.
Ruth, you have experience as a radio journalist, as a newspaper journalist as well, but you still decided to put a main focus of your work on blogging. When in Uganda we had a shutdown of a media house, or a few media houses actually, in May last year, my feeling was that your blogs and your tweets are actually the best source to find out what's going on, while the established newspapers were quite quiet and didn't report too much on it, probably not to mess with the police. You had a good source of information. So maybe can you tell us a little bit about the difference between being a blogger, maybe a little less controlled, or maybe a little more open to speak compared to a journalist in Uganda?
Okay, like I said, with the media houses, you have so many gatekeepers who are trying to first of all, you know, keep your information that they put out in check. So we're looking at the editor. So there's probably a sub-editor, then there is the editor, then there is the editor-in-chief. So you have about three people who you know that have got to go through your piece before it gets published. That's the first thing. Second thing is these media houses, primarily, I would say, meant to make money and not necessarily tell news. So there's a huge difference between that. I mean, we see that a lot with the media houses, the TV stations, and some of the newspapers in Uganda. And you can see that, you know, it's about marketing, it's about the sales, it's about getting money. And most of these are privately owned. Those that there's, well, one government-owned institution that has forever been in debt, that is, you know, that is firing people left, right, and center. They have no structures in place. But it's supposed to be run by the government. But it is not functioning. Why? Because who gets the money in the government? You know, is it the Minister of Information? Does it go back to, you know, building the infrastructure? Or, I mean, there's so many issues in that. And so there's a lot of limitations of how much you can get done and how such a good story you can write when it comes to, you know, using traditional media. That is not to say that those channels are not important, but I think that they have been misused and have not been very well put to good use by, you know, the people that run them. So they are not mainly there to, you know, tell the news. Now, the thing about online, being online, is your audience is much bigger. So we have an audience, we have a country of 32 million, you know, Ugandans. About, you know, the leading newspaper will probably sell, they say 100,000 copies daily, which is debatable. But three quarters of those will get into offices where people will just leave them lying around and never quite, you know, buy them. You know, because I work for the bank, so every day a certain number of copies of the newspapers are brought in. I mean, that's, you know, the procedure. It is not that people are paying out of their pockets to be able to buy a copy. So, you know, so there are those, you know, challenges as well. So with being online, the audience is bigger and greater, and especially the fact that I get a lot of people who are outside of the country who come and say, well, that was quite interesting what you wrote. Thank you very much for the tweets or something like that, because they realize I'm not just writing for myself. I'm writing for a big audience. And like we were saying that when you go to the analysis on my blog, you find that actually the most readers are not necessarily from Uganda, depending on what it is that I'm trying to write about. There's lots of people from all over the world. So that's the other thing. You get a bigger audience, you get a variety of audience, and then you also help, you know, to help people understand what is going on, that it is not all nice and rosy, but there's also something that, you know, needs to be done, that while the government may be saying, oh, we have built 300 hospitals around the country, also tell them that, well, thank you very much for building the hospitals, but how about the kind of people that work in them, or are they stocked with medicines or stuff like that? So it's just giving, you know, being able to give the alternative. But what I have seen that with being online, plus you're able to write as much as you can, you're able to put your opinion there, which is not seen or heard with the mainstream media, because like I said, they're driving an agenda. And if they're driving sales, then they do not want to be critical to the government. They would rather stay in line and, you know, write and say about things that are mainly, that make them happy, or, you know, that are not necessarily critical and do not encourage debate or provoke people's feelings and sentiments.
How is it in South Africa with the freedom of speech as a blogger? I mean, you're obviously very familiar with the laws also in South Africa, and we do have kind of good media laws, so the press can be very open, very free. But do you still feel an additional freedom as a blogger, or do you, in the opposite, feel that maybe the government, sometimes if you're too critical, would try to contact you and to convince you to be a little softer on them?
Well, you know, there's always a tension between any government, any people in power, let me put it this way, and those who are going to speak truth to power. So whether it's in a newspaper or on the internet, in South Africa, there's the laws are in place. You can basically write what you want within the bounds of defamation and hate speech, prohibition on hate speech. The difference is perhaps that the government is more prone to phone newspaper editors and to complain to the newspaper editors when something is published that is not nice. I have woken up after writing an opinion piece in a newspaper one morning at 6 o'clock. The premier of the state in which I stay, I said she was a hypocrite. And so she phoned me awake at 6 in the morning. So I had to tell her that she must phone again at 8 when I'm awake. So that happens. But on the things I've written on the blog or tweeted even has been responded to also by politicians, including by the presidency. So, but I think it's easier for an individual person to resist that kind of pressure than it is for a newspaper editor who, after all, in a country like South Africa, a lot of the advertising that a newspaper gets comes from government departments. So there is always that threat. So far, it would probably be unconstitutional to impose the threat, but there is that threat that we will pull our advertising from your newspaper. So I think in that sense, I am probably more free to write what I want as a blogger.
Even if you're well read, I mean, you shared a few numbers. Maybe you can share it with the audience as well. How many people do read your blog on a daily basis or after you posted it?
I don't know. I get about, because I published the blog and then it is published on the website, the Daily Maverick website. So on my personal blog, it's about 2,000 hits, 3,000 hits, depending what you write. Of course, if you write something about race relations, then 20,000 people will read it. Anything to do with race in South Africa is like putting a red rag through to a bull. And in the Daily Maverick, I don't know, they have like 50,000 people reading it a day. So it is a big audience. The interesting thing is, for example, two years ago, there was the massacre in South Africa by the police of 34 mine workers. The mainstream media didn't really report very critically on what happened there. It was only the Daily Maverick website, where my blog is also published, they actually sent people there and they exposed the fact that some of the people were actually basically assassinated by the police after they were running away. That didn't come out in the mainstream media. Why? Because perhaps big mining houses, they're going to advertise in the paper. You know, there are all those kind of complicated things about freedom of speech that are entwined with wanting to make money out of your product, which if you're a blogger or if you're on an online platform, is perhaps less oppressive. It is less clear the self censorship that happens.
In Malawi and in Uganda, the media laws are not as good. Actually, journalists can get fined for being too critical with government officials. There's the big discussion around government secrets, which are not to be shared. Jimmy, how do you feel as a blogger? How do you feel in that area with the law? Do you feel threatened? I mean, Ethiopia, it's a little further north, but in Ethiopia, people can go to jail if they are blogging the wrong stuff. Mm-hmm. So how's the situation in Malawi?
Strict laws are there, on paper mostly. In Malawi, you're not allowed to criticize the president, and that's a given fact. It's constitutionary. Whatever constitutes to criticism, it depends on who defines what criticism is. But there's always that danger that you have to sometimes think twice what you're trying to say. There are loose sort of laws and regulations that people get arrested for. So, for example, there's this idea that if you write or say something, you are unlikely to cause or breach national peace, whatever it is. that can include commenting on the president's dress code or his wife or her wife, whoever is involved. But personally, and I know there are a few people that are making comments or blogging, there has not been a lot of restrictions from the government. One of the reasons I'd say, perhaps because they are acutely aware of government, that the people that are following bloggers, there might be influential people following bloggers and listening to what we're writing on different social media platforms, but it's a small figure given that majority of Malawians still live in rural areas where internet penetration is still not there. About 84% of the population are rural-based. And, you know, if you think about that figure, it's huge in terms of someone trying to get a mandate from the state. So they are happy enough, I think, to let people criticize and let people talk. But what you get in most cases are actually the followers of what is the ruling party at the time. In Malawi, and I believe similar to most African countries, you can hardly differentiate between what is a ruling party and what is the government. Okay, the ruling party is a de facto government of the day as well. So what you have to deal with in most cases is not the law itself, but you have to deal with are the supporters or the ruling party when you stand up and say things. And these are the people that have no any sort of principle or principles or any ideological standing. All that matters to them is the parties in power. It's there. Everything they're doing is nice, and you know, and all that. So I think the main obstacle isn't really the government coming at you, but in most cases, what I'd call citizen police, you know, defending their own ruling party.
So we have now 10 to 15 minutes left on this panel. That's why I would like to open the floor at this stage and ask you for your questions to our bloggers. If you have questions, please introduce yourself quickly and also let us know who you want to address with a question. Who wants to start? It's a very familiar surrounding here, so we can be relaxed and open.
But please, you cannot speak German. Nein, no, parlez-vous français. But Afrikaans I can do.
Okay, any questions so far? Okay, if not, then I will go on with asking you the questions. Maybe it's time to talk a little bit about the Africa blogging network that we established in Nairobi, even if it's very young already. Ruth and Jimmy, you're both editors of this network. The idea is to train African political bloggers to make them more visible and also to collect some of their blog posts on a webpage to promote them better. So how would you describe the network of bloggers? Maybe we can talk about Eastern Africa in this case. Do you know each other? Do you work with each other? How has that been so far?
Well, in my experience, I have met and interacted with bloggers from Kenya a lot, unlike Tanzania and unlike Rwanda and Burundi, because that's what forms the East African community. With Kenya, the tech scene obviously is more vibrant than it is in Uganda, and they're a little bit more open-minded. They have, you know, they're very respected in their opinions, and they have quite a huge range of bloggers because they have everything from travel bloggers to people that have cooking blogs and all that, which you're yet to find in Uganda. So it is, they have a lot of entertainment. If you're looking to know what's happening in Kenya, then you probably will land on a few great sites. The other thing is they already have the BEC, which is the Association of Bloggers Awards Kenya, that rewards the bloggers. I think every year they've been doing it for quite a while now. So you know who is leading, who is the leading political blogger, why they are, the stuff like that. We're just starting out in Uganda. The thing about it has been that those that started blogging, there wasn't a need to bring people together. It's just now that we're starting, and we're hoping to have our first blog camp in March. If we're looking for funding, we have a few hints here and there. So if that happens, then that will be the first bloggers camp, which should be a huge step for us in the right direction, to be able to bring bloggers together, train them, help them understand what it means to put your content out there, talk about copyright and cyber laws and all those things, and also mentor them. So for those that have made it, how have they done? So, and also hopefully we'll get companies to respect bloggers. I mean, it's still one of those things that, it's hard to make a living in Uganda as a blogger, I must say. And because online, people, what do you do, blog what? You know, it's a process. I have that conversation with my father every other day. it's like, so what do you do? So when people come ask me ask him, what does your daughter do? He's like, well, go ask her. And then after a while, that's a conversation, because people are not yet open to what being online, writing online, putting on content online. The organizations like UNICEF there would be organizations, because they have influence from outside of the country, so they understand, what it means to have a voice online. But then for the locally homegrown, it's still competing with radio, especially when you can go and have a sleazy advert on radio that will run for 3-4 months, and after, within a month, everyone is singing it. Then you talk to me about what does it mean to be online? What are the rewards that I will get? And so there's that imbalance. Now, when it comes to Tanzania, they mostly, write their stuff in Swahili. So it's also hard for us to be able to connect and understand what's going on in their country. And apparently they have a very, very well, grown culture of blogging. But their content is in Swahili. So it's hard for the other East African countries to, identify with them, which is the same with Rwanda and Burundi, because they're still in the middle of... Rwanda is still doing half English, half French, and a lot of Rwandese, Runyaranda. So it's hard to communicate with them. And Burundi is mainly French, but they also haven't opened up to being online because there are very many restrictions there. So it's quite a journey that we still have to make. Yeah.
Jimmy, you have already worked with two blogger collectives, I think you can call them, Africa on the Block and Global Voices. What is your experience? Do you think you reached your aim to give a proper picture of different African countries on those blogs?
Especially in Africa on the blog, the idea about that blog basically, it's a mad author blog. So whoever is interested about African issues, you don't have to be an African, but if you are interested on reporting or writing on issues about Africa from African perspective, everyone is welcome to contribute. I have to say, achieving what the blog was initially meant to do, I'd say no, because one of the reasons is when you put that agenda across, it's like you're trying to challenge the existing norms and values. And here, you just mentioned earlier on about, okay, so here we're talking about Africa. We have three people here from three different African countries. Mm-hmm. Africa is not a country, it's a continent. So it's the same idea that you're trying to challenge and how people view Africa. So we've had sort of a selection, group of people. But what I've discovered, I think it started in 2011, 2010, 2011. But what I've discovered that a lot of popular articles or blogs on that blog actually turns out to be things like African recipe, African dressings, like that, those kind of fashion, cooking, that kind of stuff. When you look at hits and links visited, one of the main reasons I think is that a lot of people looking for information about Africa, they rather jump on to established news organizations. You go on BBC website, you go on all those news organizations to look at what is actually happening in Africa, thereby bypassing the voices of the actual Africans themselves. And I think this is one of the main obstacles that, you know, we find is still a problem with a lot of bloggers. I'll give you an example, like in my country, for instance. Most people that people take seriously in the, you know, in terms of blogging, they look at, okay, so what do they do? Because blogging to them is not an activity. Mm-hmm. So for example, like I get a phone calls or emails from reporters, journalists, you know, trying to get my views on issues. What they emphasize most is, oh, he works with the University of Malawi, he's a lecturer at the University of Malawi. But the truth is my blogging has got nothing to do with my professional work as a lecturer. But they're trying to put in that emphasis so that people can take you seriously one way or the other, that, okay, there's this issue. And I think that is a big problem itself, because if somebody really wants to know Africa, understand Africa, what you need to bypass are not bloggers. You need to bypass big news organizations that they've got framed agendas, or, you know, they've got, you know, this perception how Africa should be covered and how things in Africa should be done. I'll give you an example. I think in 2012, BBC have this program or initiative, they say Africa Debate. So they pick a topic, they go to different countries and discuss issues. In 2012, in the aftermath of the so-called Arab Spring, they were looking, you know, they were having a debate, I think it was on Burkina Faso at that time, mm-hmm. on why sub-Saharan Africa didn't have same uprising like in North Africa. So they asked me to write an article. So they emphasized that, you know, don't make it too niche, don't make it too academic, just make it, you know, in a way that everybody should really get what Africa is all about. So I said, okay, I'll write an article the way I see it. If it doesn't work, let me know. What that tells me is that even the established news organizations, they're uncomfortable with bloggers themselves, because they think you are out of line. You cannot work in the way that news organizations are structured. And I think that is one of the problems that trying to confront when you say, okay, we're trying to tell stories from African perspective. It's like you're bypassing, it's like challenging traditional ways of how news is reported, because news as journalism is actually structured. There's a way, it's defined in a certain way. So it's trying like to challenge that sort of definition. One of those reasons is because Africa is a very diverse place. I write things, sometimes I've been blogging about Malawi. I think I understand Malawi very well. Sometimes I get comments that, you know, to me should be obvious. But then you realize how diverse just Malawi itself is as a country. So you're thinking about Africa as continent with 54 countries. You cannot just frame it as one issue. Whilst for most people to understand it, the easiest way of doing it is to understand it as Africa, because it takes a lot less effort to do that, and that doesn't help. So the challenge is to try and make that clear. So most of those blogs, it's a problem that we're actually facing. You put that information out, most people bypass it. They'll rather see, you know, recipe about how we cook okra in Africa, for example. Yeah.
I would like, Pierre, to start my round of final mm-hmm. statements mm-hmm. with you. And I actually would like to give all of you the same question, which is, again, going back to the topic of this conference. How do you see, like, when you look into your glass bowl mm-hmm. and look into the future, how do you see the digital sphere interacting or changing the society in South Africa, in Malawi, and in Uganda? And maybe what do we need to be cautious of in this process?
Oh, that's a difficult question, but okay, let me try. I think you must make a distinction between different platforms. So there's a huge difference between what happens on Twitter and what its effect is, and what happens on, say, a blog. The value of blogs, I think, is especially that it can provide far more insight, in-depth explanation, analysis, that especially in newspapers that are struggling to make a living, that cannot be published there. So there's a big opportunity for people to be better informed with a more diverse range of voices through blogging. The Twitter, I think, is a completely different animal, because that is really where instantly different people can try and insert themselves into the political debate in order to frame a certain question. So when something happens in South Africa that is very in the news and I feel very passionate about it, I immediately put something on Twitter to try and say, this is the lens through which you have to look at it. And there's going to be far more contestation, I think, about different people trying to bring different voices out. Having said all that, I think from a South African perspective, for me, what is going to be interesting is to see how the government and other powerful organizations, big business and so on, how are they going to respond to this chaotic democracy that is out there on the internet? And are they going to try and make it more orderly? In other words, are they going to try and impose some kind of control? And if they do, are they going to be successful? I suspect not, but let's see.
Thank you very much. Jimmy?
I'd like to agree with what he says. Sometimes it's easy to forget when you are in your element, I'd say, you know, try to say things, to do things. Like the example I was giving about Twitter this morning. Sometimes I go there, discuss things, and I get satisfied from what I've said. And I know, for example, a colleague at the University of Malawi, a very good blogger, said to me, so, since Twitter, I've become very lazy. I don't really blog as much. You know, I feel satisfied when I've got 140 characters or less to say something on Twitter and people respond immediately. But I think tweets are putting something on social media. In many cases, it's difficult to sustain it as it is. If you blog, if you write an article, you've got established space where people can come back and forth, maybe to try and find information and all that. But as I said earlier, when I think the whole thing sort of complement each other. Without social media, okay, I'm trying to differentiate social media as we're thinking of instant messagings and all that. Without it, it would be far much more difficult to have a blog because, you know, you don't have a platform actually to share the information from. In my country, most people use Facebook for various reasons that it's not as cumbersome as Twitter. You know, Twitter, you just have to be the point. You know, there's a certain, you know, limitation on what you can say and what you can do. For some reason, don't really use Facebook. I go there time and again just to see what is happening in the country. Then I can pick up issues and all that. But because I've really gone into sort of academic way of looking at things, so I'm not at ease to express myself and try to explain things easily on social media without actually putting into deep, you know, perspective in how things should be and all that. So I think that's why I stick a lot with blogging. And also, in many cases, as she said, because initially, really, I think, and that's why maybe I've sustained my passion about blogging and all that, because as a kid growing up, I've always thought I'll do journalism or end up becoming a lawyer, maybe, because I thought those are two things that people could use in society, maybe to change things and all that. But as I grew up, went to university and all that, I found that maybe those are probably the most two collapsed professionals I could get into. So I maintained that passion for writing and all that. But given journalism, the way journalism, say, works in my country, I've resorted to the point that, okay, I think maybe blogging is a better way. Like he said, there are so many limitations if you're working for news organizations because it's easy for governments and, you know, whoever is interested, corporations, to target news organizations because of political, social, and economic interest or those that who owns those organizations, be it a government or someone. But as an individual, you've got that sort of freedom to open up and say things. But as you go on, you become sort of, say, a blind sort of voice of reason. People start to pay attention to what they're saying. Like today, if I'm to retweet something on Twitter, put something on Twitter, I have to think twice because I know I've got certain number following. People take seriously what I say on it than they would maybe 4 or 5 years ago because nobody really cared who I was and all that. So as you go on, whether you like it or not, you become more responsible, and you know, you really have to, you know, to be careful with what you're saying, because there's a number of people that follow you and take you seriously.
Thank you. And Ruth, for the last statement.
There's 1 billion people on the continent that are using mobile phones. And they're using mobile phones to access Facebook. The numbers have probably gone higher than that, because access of internet is there's more access to the internet, and there's more access to mobile phones, especially the smartphones, because we have new players in the market that are trying to create cheap phones that people can use. So when we talk about, you know, digital, you know, digitalization and transformation in the world and on the continent, we are looking at a certain fraction of people that exist that I say we cannot ignore. And so so when you ask, do you think that, you know, going forward, you know, this is something that we are looking at that is going to last? Of course it is going to last. And I think we already see the impact with the Arab Spring, with countries like Kenya, where if Uhuru Kenyatta is going to have something to say, the first thing that he puts it on is on Twitter. With the, you know, like President Zuma in South Africa, who once in a while, before his State of the Nation address, will ask, what do you want us to talk about? And they'll actually listen to what people have to say using Twitter and Facebook, and they will include that. And I think that this does not mean that traditional media is going to go, that is going to die out. My grandmother still owns a feature phone, but relevant to her is radio. My auntie, who lives maybe in the township, relevant to her is television. And then I can come back home, and I mean, where I live in the city, and what we are beginning to see, which is something that Google has, I think, know that that tech futurists have talked about, is the 3/4 screen syndrome. So you have a tablet, you have a computer, you have a smartphone, and then you have the television on. Somehow you will not fail to pay your cable for your cable when the month ends. You still pay for it, but you still have the smartphone, and you know when you need it. You still have this. So even at a certain time, like at 9 p.m. when you get home, you probably have all those three gadgets on at the same time. And we continue to see that into the future, because news outlets now realize that they have got to go online. And so I think that the trends, I mean, anything that has to do with technology continues to be a part of our lives. The trends continue to become dynamic. We have innovations left, right, and center. But that does not mean that we are eliminating. I think we're just looking at harnessing what there is for us and being able to tell the news properly, and which is what I tell journalists, which is what I tell, you know, news outlets in Uganda, that they need to be... What is... You cannot have a reflection... I mean, you cannot have... What happens online is a reflection of what happens offline. So you as a newspaper, you cannot be telling the... different stories from, you know, offline and online. It has got to be in sync, and it has got to be, you know, there's got to be a balance between the two, which is something I have written on when our leading television station decided to run with the story without doing any background information whatsoever. And they must have been shocked, because these are people I have worked with. These are people that I go and train and talk about, you know, talk to. And I said, you cannot do that. You cannot, because you saw one or two tweets without verifying, go and have a story. And, you know, it does not make sense. You cannot do that. So people have got to understand that it is not a competition between traditional and digital. Rather, it is kind of enhancing what already is there. Because realizing that there's 20,000 people on Twitter in Uganda, and you cannot ignore them. They have something to say, and sometimes they do set the agenda in what is talked about. And also looking at the people that have mobile phones in Kenya, in South Africa, in whichever country, and knowing that the people on Facebook in Tunisia and, you know, in the Maghreb region, and that they have opinions, and that is where they feel comfortable airing their opinions. And so you need to meet them there, understand what they have to say, but also come back, to use the other mediums to reach out to the rest of the population.
Thank you very much. Thank you all of the panelists for painting this detailed picture of African countries, of different African countries, of the blogosphere in Africa. I hope that the audience took away a lot. I also hope you will take away the Twitter handles and the blog addresses which are in the program, so you can do what Ruth just mentioned towards the end, get a proper picture about opinions, about news from the African continent. Thank you to the audience for your interest, for bearing with us. And I would like to close this panel now and leave you to the tea break. Thank you very much.